Good morning. On today's programme, why are so many wealthy Indian citizens leaving the country? And we hear about a Canadian children's author who's been approved for medically assisted dying, reigniting a debate over the controversial issue. But first we go to Sao Paulo in Brazil, where history was made last week when it convicted a former president and top military officers for attempting to overturn democratic elections. Former President Jair Bolsonaro was sentenced to 27 years and 3 months for his part in a failed coup attempt following his loss to rival Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva in the 2022 elections. President Donald Trump has called the conviction a witch hunt. From Sao Paulo, Sam Cowie reports.
In the week following his conviction, Jair Bolsonaro was rushed to hospital, suffering from violent bouts of vomiting and hiccups, along with low blood pressure. One of his politician sons, Senator Flavio Bolsonaro, said the episodes left him breathless for nearly 10 seconds at a time, wearing an ankle monitor and under house arrest in the capital Brasilia since August the 4th. He did not attend last week's historic verdict. The hard-right former president was sentenced to 27 years and 3 months for his part in a failed coup attempt following the loss to his leftist rival, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, in the 2022 elections. Several high-ranking military officers also received long sentences. Prosecutors said that the plan included assassinating Lula, his vice president Geraldo Alckmin, and Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes, who has become an arch-enemy of Brazil's far right. The ruling came from inside Brasilia's Supreme Court palace. The same building was ransacked by Bolsonaro loyalists on January the 8th, 2023, just days after Lula was sworn in. Justice Carmen Lucia called the conviction a meeting of Brazil with its past, its present, and its future. Meanwhile, United States President Donald Trump, of whom Bolsonaro is an outspoken admirer, called the conviction a witch hunt. Last Monday, on a visit to Israel, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said that the United States would take further measures against Brazil. Latin America's largest economy already received 50% tariffs on a wide range of its products in August, the result of Bolsonaro's lawmaker son Eduardo's lobbying in Washington. Meanwhile, Bolsonaro's allies in Congress have scrambled to push for an amnesty. So far, according to reports in the Brazilian press, citing backroom chatter from the corridors of power, a full amnesty, meaning that Bolsonaro would walk free and even run in next year's elections, isn't on the table. It's widely known in Brasilia that all but the most loyal of Bolsonaro's lawmaker colleagues want a different right-wing presidential candidate in 2026. Currently, it seems that the best he can hope for is a reduction in his sentence. That said, at 70 years old and in ill health, it's unlikely he would serve much of the sentence anyway. But Brazil is a volatile place. The country has long avoided punishing its powerful. Carlos Fico is a history professor at the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro and the author of Brazilian Authoritarian Utopia. He says that since 1889, the country has suffered 15 coups or attempted coups, none of which were punished. According to him, coup attempts were pardoned, and this impunity served as an incentive for new coups. Brazil's 1964 to 1985 military dictatorship began when generals forcefully deposed left-leaning João Goulart from power with support from the United States. Hundreds of political activists were killed or disappeared over the years. Thousands more were tortured. Brazil set a blueprint for US-backed authoritarian regimes across Latin America. However, unlike Argentina and Chile, Brazil never held dictatorship-era trials. In 1979, the last dictatorship president, General João Figueiredo, passed the amnesty law. It granted amnesty to political prisoners, exiles, and dissidents persecuted during the military regime. But crucially, it also shielded military officials and state agents from prosecution for crimes like torture, forced disappearances, and extrajudicial killings. Bolsonaro himself has long been an outspoken apologist for the most violent and depraved elements of Brazil's dictatorship. He once called the notorious torturer, Colonel Carlos Alberto Brilhante Ustra, a national hero. Now under house arrest, banned from social media and waiting to start his sentence, he cuts a far less bombastic and more frail figure. But if democracy is a never-ending fight, then Brazil is perpetually on the front line of the battlefield. For World Report in Sao Paulo, I'm Sam Cowie.
Next, we go to Canada. This week, a well-known and beloved Canadian author revealed that he'd been approved for medical assistance in dying. 80-year-old Robert Munch, who has written more than 70 children's books, was diagnosed with dementia in 2021 and has Parkinson's disease. Canada first legalized euthanasia in 2016 for people with terminal illnesses. In 2021, the law was changed to include those with serious and chronic physical conditions, even in non-life-threatening circumstances. The issue of medical assistance in dying is controversial in Canada and around the world, with debate over legal, ethical, and healthcare issues continuing, as Dan Karpinchuk reports.
Robert Munch says no date for his medically assisted death has been set yet because Canadian law requires that patients actively consent to the procedure at the time of their death. That is, they must still have decision-making capacity. The iconic children's writer has penned favorites such as Love You Forever, The Paper Bag Princess, and Mortimer, to name a few. He has said that even though the stories will remain with him, he himself is slipping away. He says he can't drive or ride a bicycle and he can't write, adding that it's been really whittling away on who he thought he was. Strangely enough, he adds, the stories are still there. They will be the last thing to go. Munch revealed in an interview with the CBC in 2021 that he had been diagnosed with dementia. He also has Parkinson's disease. He told the New York Times in a recent interview that after the diagnosis, he applied for and was approved shortly after for medical assistance in dying. Although no date has been set, Munch said he can't wait much longer. He explained that when he begins to have real trouble talking and communicating, then he'll know it's time to pick the moment. Robert Norman Munch was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in June of 1945. After graduating from Boston University in 1971, he studied to become a Jesuit priest. He decided he would rather work with children after holding jobs at orphanages and daycare centers. In 1973, he received a Master of Education in Child Studies. Then in 1975, he moved to Canada, where he worked in the Family Studies Department at the University of Guelph, west of Toronto. While there, he was encouraged to publish the stories he made up for the children he worked with. His stories are usually based on real children he met during school visits and performances. He said many of his books, such as Stephanie's Ponytail and Think Big, were inspired by children he met on his tours. He said as a storyteller, he writes books for kids, talks to kids, and listens to kids. One book in particular reflected his own personal grief. He and his wife Anne could not have children of their own. Two were stillborn. They ended up adopting three. That inspired Love You Forever, which was published in 1986. It traces a mother's love across many years and was a bestseller in Canada for three consecutive years. The book also turned out to be a bestseller in the U.S. It sold more than 8 million copies in paperback and hardcover. Munch said he had to change publishers because his regular publisher refused to do it. Another book, The Paper Bag Princess, sold more than 7 million copies and is considered a literary classic. The 80-year-old Munch has written more than 70 children's books and sold more than 80 million copies of his books in North America alone. His books have been translated into 20 languages, including Arabic and Swedish. In 1991, some of his works were adapted into an animated television series called A Bunch of Munch. He's won a Juno Award. He was named Author of the Year by the Canadian Booksellers Association in 1999. A star on Canada's Walk of Fame, and in 2009 he became a member of the Order of Canada. His last book, named Bounce, was written in 2023. Meanwhile, his daughter Julie has taken to social media to say her father isn't dying anytime soon. She thanked people for their well wishes, but emphasized that her father is still doing well. She said he made his choice about assisted dying 5 years ago. She does say his degenerative disease can begin to progress quickly at any point. Munch himself said he made the decision after witnessing one of his brothers die slowly from Lou Gehrig's disease. Longtime publishers Anik Press, Scholastic Canada, and Firefly Books shared a social media post this week in the wake of the New York Times interview. They said they were profoundly grateful to Munch for his personal reflections. They wrote, "As proud publishers of Robert Munch's beloved books, we are grateful for all the stories he shared, including his own. The issue of medical assistance in dying is still controversial in Canada and around the world, with debate over legal, ethical, and healthcare issues continuing. Less than a dozen other countries, including Australia, New Zealand, Spain, Belgium, and the Netherlands, have laws dealing with the issue, but the criteria, eligibility, and methods vary. Some countries focus on terminal illness, and some include medical health conditions as the basis. Critics question the potential discrimination against people with disabilities, with the risk of assisted dying becoming a substitute for inadequate social support. They also argue that it might be offered prematurely, especially for people with suicidal thoughts. Those in favor say it's about a person's right to end suffering. Medical assistance in dying became law in Canada in 2016. Since then, the number of assisted death recipients has steadily increased. There were more than 15,000 in Canada in 2023. For World Report, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Finally, we go to India. Many of India's richest citizens are saying goodbye to the world's largest democracy and settling down in other countries for a better lifestyle and ease of doing business. Official figures reveal that as many as 2 million Indians have acquired other nationalities between 2011 and 2025. While they may be following in the footsteps of wealthy Russians and Chinese, the question remains, why are Indians fleeing an established democracy? Sajida Momin has this report.
A growing number of wealthy Indians are leaving the country of their birth for developed Western nations and buying a new nationality and passport. This striking new trend is causing both concern and amusement in the world's biggest democracy and most populous nation. Just last month, the Indian government admitted on the floor of Parliament that over 1 million people had given up their citizenship in 5 years between 2019 and 2024 and acquired other nationalities. It means that 200,000 richest and brightest Indians renounced their passports every year in the last 5 years for a better life in other nations. Official data reveals that between 2011 and mid-2023, as many as 1.75 million Indians gave up their citizenship to emigrate to 135 countries around the world, including the United States, United Kingdom, France, Germany, the Vatican, Iceland, South Africa, Turkey, Portugal, Brazil, and Antigua and Barbuda Islands in the Caribbean. Altogether, over 2 million Indians have renounced their nationality between 2011 and 2025. The figures clearly show that the momentum has picked up, especially since 2022. These damning and troubling statistics of wealthy and successful Indians queuing up to surrender their blue passports were placed in Parliament by the Junior Minister of External Affairs, Kirti Vardhan Singh. In this bleak scenario, Singh tried to give a twist to the exodus by claiming that a successful, prosperous, and influential diaspora is an asset for India. But his brave words failed to change the overall perception that hordes of well-to-do Indians are deserting the country for various reasons. Interestingly, a timely new book has shone a torch on the exodus. The title of the book, released soon after the government's disclosure, is provocative and thought-provoking. The Secession of the Successful, The Flight of New India, is penned by leading political commentator Sanjay Baru, who served as the press advisor and official spokesperson of former Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, who helmed India from 2004 to 2014, before the advent of the current dispensation led by Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The New India, in the book's title, is borrowed from the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party's official description of post-2014 India under Modi's charismatic leadership, as opposed to the old India when the Congress Party won election after election and was in power for many decades. Baru is the author of several books on contemporary India and a newspaper columnist. Discerning readers are hooked to because he calls a spade a spade. He is one of the few critical voices left in the country's media landscape, but his narrative is usually so well researched and factual that it is almost impossible to counter or contradict what he writes. Baru's new work painstakingly depicts the different phases of migration from India. During British rule from the middle of the 19th century to the first quarter of the 20th century, A staggering number of Indians were forcibly shipped as indentured labour to different colonies of the British Empire. Their descendants comprise the Indian origin population of countries ranging from Fiji in the Pacific to Mauritius in the Indian Ocean and Trinidad, Tobago and Suriname further afield. In the 1970s, the Gulf boom drew skilled and semi-skilled workers from India. The migration of the not-so-well-off to the Middle East coincided with the flight of middle-class professionals like doctors, engineers, and chartered accountants to the English-speaking world, especially the United States, United Kingdom, and Australia. This trend peaked around 1999 when Indian technological companies like Infosys, Wipro, and TCS, encouraged by the liberalization of immigration policy by the United States, started flooding America with software engineers. What bothers Baru and many others is the current exodus of rich Indians, particularly the children of the politically and socially powerful elite. According to him, the present trend of deserting India is nothing short of the secession of the successful. Quoting data from global consultancy firm Morgan & Stanley, he writes that around 23,000 Indians with a net worth of over $1 million have left the country since 2012. The net worth of Indian billionaires has grown by 280% between 2014 and 2022, which amounts to 10 times the growth of India's national income in that period. Baru writes that the India's super rich have the wherewithal to buy nationalities of developed countries and live there, enjoying first world perks which are unimaginable in Delhi, Mumbai or Bangalore. Baru has divided the emigrants from New India into four categories. Firstly, billionaire businessmen who are fugitives from the law. Secondly, first-generation wealthy who are not comfortable with the current political and bureaucratic regime in India as they lack political connections. Thirdly, those desirous of de-risking and diversifying from an uncertain economic, regulatory and governance environment in India. And fourthly, wealthy Indians seeking a better lifestyle or quality of life away from third world India. Some analysts say that even Chinese and Russian billionaires are relocating to the West, but they are escaping dictatorships and societies where freedoms are curtailed. The trend in India, which is an established democracy, therefore calls for deeper introspection. For World Report, I'm Sajida Momin in India.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Margaret Curley. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report, or you'll find us on all podcast platforms. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.